The road to hell has been so well paved with good intentions. For me, the fact that food, the very growing of our nourishment, the source of livelihood for half of humanity, the source of survival for all beings, has been reduced to one of the most dangerous activities, is an example of how we walk the road to hell. For me, the wake-up call on this issue came in 1984. I don't know how many of you remember a disaster called Bhopal. Now, the factory in Bhopal, owned by Union Carbide, was a factory for producing pesticides. And in the 1970s, when Union Carbide had located an old factory from America to India, they had talked about India's wonderful future with chemistry. On that night in December 1984, 3,000 people were killed with one leak. Since then, 30,000 people have died. Even today, the women of Bhopal are sitting in Delhi asking for justice. They came just before I left. I went to offer solidarity. They came with 150 malformed children because that poison is still in the water. And every day the water they drink is threatening future generations. Bhopal, of course, was one leak of a toxic at an instant. But those toxics are used to grow our food every day. It's something I learned along the way because of a second incident in Bhopal, in India, in 1984. I had not realized, because I was a physicist, and physicists are very innocent beings. You know, we live with our equations, we live with our elementary particles. We have absolutely no idea there's something called the World Bank organizing our lives. There's something called the Green Revolution destroying our biodiversity. But 1984, I was forced to look at this because Punjab, where the Green Revolution, which is the name for industrial agriculture when introduced to the third world, Punjab, the land of the Green Revolution, was at war. We had the worst form of terrorism and extremism that too killed 30,000 people. Now, the Green Revolution had been given a Nobel Peace Prize, 1970. And the argument was miracle seeds and miracle chemicals are going to create so much prosperity that never again will people fight with each other. And the Green Revolution was an alternative to the Red Revolution. That's why it was called green. There was nothing green about it. It was called green because it was not red. And it was about plants, so they just said green. Well, it wasn't. It was a very bloody revolution. And it continues to be. The chemicals that were brought into agriculture were war chemicals. Companies that had built up chemicals to kill human beings figured out, why should we shut these factories down? Let's continue to sell them as agrochemicals. All pesticides, all herbicides came out of the war to kill human beings. They continue to kill silently in our fields today. Agent Orange, yesterday, there was a 1968 connection made, the Viet Cong. Agent Orange was the chemical created to burn the forests so that the Viet Cong camps could be seen in Vietnam. Agent Orange is sold as a herbicide across the world today. 2,4-3-D. And of course, the fascinating thing is herbicides like this or Roundup are sold as liberators of women. Because the majority of work in agriculture in the third world is in weeding. But weeding is not just producing waste. Weeding is getting the fodder for your cattle, the medicine for your children, the food and nutrition. So much of the greens that we eat are actually associate crops that come up on their own in our fields. I have seen an ad of Monsanto showing women's hands tied up in green, and the advertisement says, Roundup liberates women. That you don't have to work now, you just spray the toxic. And Roundup in their advertisement says, it kills everything green that it comes in contact with. The advertisements even say that now that we have genetically engineered seed, we prevent the weeds from stealing the sunshine. That even the sun is supposed to be only for them, not for other plants, not for human beings, not for the planet, just for growing that one crop they want to grow. The seeds, the miracle seeds of the so-called Green Revolution, the mythology about it is it produced more food, it got rid of famine. The reality about it is native seeds don't like chemicals. They lodge. It's not that local crops don't give enough food, they give tremendous food. But the war industry had to create new crops that could withstand the war chemicals. And so they changed, they engineered the plant for the chemicals. And these were the so-called dwarf varieties of Norman Borlaug, for which he got the Nobel Peace Prize. Interestingly, even though this was sold as a scientific miracle, Borlaug had 12 students whom he called his apostles, whom he sent around the world to spread the new religion of chemical agriculture. And unfortunately, it was spread in the name of the Green Revolution. Now, genetic engineering is being sold as the second Green Revolution. We are in the middle of a tremendous food crisis, and everyone admits it. 3 days, 4 days from now, the United Nations will meet in Rome to address this food crisis. But from everything I am reading, the global powers, whether it be the World Bank, or it be the FAO, or it be the World Trade Organization, or it be Mr. Bush, they are offering the disease as the cure. The disease that has given us the food crisis. Just a moment. The disease that has given us the food crisis is the disease of industrialized agriculture and globalized trade in food. Industrialized agriculture creates hunger in three ways, even though it's about producing more food. The first level at which it creates hunger is it destroys sources of nutrition. Humanity has eaten about 100,000 plants. In the small farms of the third world, not affected by commercial agriculture, you still see farms with 200 species, 300 species. Every one of them meets a need, huge need of nutrition. Many of you are doctors. The absence of greens in the diet is the most significant problem in malnutrition right now. 70% of the women I know in India, and 70% children, suffer from anemia. lack of iron. Could be easily met from greens. Greens grow in abundance till you bring in chemical agriculture and start blasting them out with herbicides. There is no chance for a green in your diet in an agriculture designed around war chemicals. War chemicals create monocultures. Monocultures are actually impoverished systems of production. Nutritionally, they produce less per acre. But there is another trick that has been played where production in agriculture is not counted in terms of how much do you produce in terms of food or nutrition. It is how few people work in agriculture. So magically, the more you can displace people, the more productive your system becomes. The more you destroy small farms and turn agriculture into corporate farms, you are becoming more productive by definition, because the input measured is human labor. Not energy, not resources, not water, and the output measured is a commodity, not nutrition. The second reason why the system necessarily creates hunger, and again, most of you will know that food-related diseases are the biggest diseases on the planet. 1 billion people are condemned to lack of food. Another 2 billion who do eat have food-related diseases, obesity, diabetes, hypertension, related to an impoverished diet based purely on, used to be cereals, and now based on two crops, corn and soya. Well, when, as a small farmer, I buy chemicals on credit to grow the food, I am growing rice, but I cannot eat that rice because I must sell it off to pay for the chemicals. That is the second big reason of hunger in the world today. Farm after farm that I have seen, it's not that food isn't growing in our fields, but people can't retain their food because they are paying for the chemicals through their nutrition. And then when they buy the food, it is 4 times more costly. Because what the farmer sells and what a consumer buys has a huge difference in a corporate-dominated economy. So you eat about a quarter of what you could have eaten if you had grown your own food, because you can't afford to buy it. And you're getting into debt even to buy your food. The third reason why this system is creating the food crisis is because, as a result of globalization and free trade, the economies of the world have been tied together. They have been forced to be linked. And the only players who can link the global food economy are 5 giants that control the grain trade. Every ship that brings corn and soya from Latin America and North America to Europe is a ship owned by Cargill or Archer Daniel Midland or Conagra. We don't see their names on the finished product. They are literally invisible giants. Cargill was the biggest, and it bought up the second biggest about 8 years ago. The second biggest company used to be called Continental. Today, Cargill includes Continental. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the agreement on agriculture in the World Trade Organization. It was drafted by Cargill. The Cargill representative was deputed from the company to the government of the United States to write the treaty that came to be known as the Agreement on Agriculture. Once it was put in place, the representative went right back to the company. This is also what happened with the trade-related intellectual property rights, where Monsanto is on record saying we were the patient, diagnostician, the physician, all in one. The companies write these agreements, which are then given the status of multilateral agreements. They're actually corporate agreements. The agreement on agriculture allowed Cargill to grab the markets of Africa, of Latin America, of India, by force. When I say by force, I mean cases brought against India in the WTO to remove restrictions on import. We grow enough rice, 91 million tons. We grow enough wheat, 76 million tons. We don't need to import. We are forced to import. And as our economy gets linked, a perturbation in the Chicago Commodity Exchange changes the price in an African village and in an Indian village. Because now it is all interconnected. And you can understand the difference. If, as an Indian, I live in an Indian village, I can buy in a rupee economy. But how can I compete? Not just with a dollar economy, but now a dollar economy that has new features built into it. And these are new features driving the food crisis. Food has been turned into a commodity. Food till recently was food. You grew food to maintain your body, to provide nutrition. Nutrition went out of the window with the Green Revolution. Now the food produced chemically is nutritionally empty mass. And you can just look at the data of how over the years the nutritional content of food has just disappeared. Besides the fact that nutritional aspects of crops have disappeared, because we are only growing a handful of commodities, the commodities themselves have very low magnesium, very low iron, very low calcium, the micronutrients and trace elements vital for our health. Now, as all the agriculture of the world starts to get controlled by the handful of grain giants, these grain giants are not just doing buying and selling of food. They're doing what is called price fixing. Now, price fixing means they can take the price down if they want to capture a market, and they can put a price up when they have captured a market. Nature of monopolies is once they're established, they can charge what they want. That's a very important reason for why prices are going up. The speculative control of agribusiness over the food system. I had a debate with an FAO representative some days back on radio, and the FAO representative was saying there's no proof that there's speculation. I said, what more proof do you want than the fact that the profits of these companies have doubled over the past year? Why millions more have gone into hunger? Because half of humanity was eating half of what they need already. If food prices double, they're eating a quarter. And if they continue to grow up, so many will not eat at all. Prices will continue to go up because once food is turned into a commodity can be used for anything else. It's substitutable. Today, it is more profitable for these agribusiness corporations to collect subsidies for biofuel than to provide food to people. So they're taking control of agriculture, but not bringing the produce back to eating. They're taking control over agriculture and then turning corn into ethanol to run cars, soya into biodiesel, palm oil into biodiesel. And unfortunately, in Europe and the US, there are now laws that treat this as a green energy. It's not a green energy because it's cutting down rainforests, leading to increased emissions. I have just released a report, and I've released two reports, and I'm going to leave them with you. On my assessment, industrial agriculture accounts for 14% of greenhouse gases and climate change. Globalized trade in agriculture accounts for another 10%, and the destruction of the forests in order to grow biofuel accounts for another 14-15%. Put together, we are talking about 40% of the climate problem coming from an economy of greed in food. We could solve the climate problem tomorrow by replacing this globalized industrialized agriculture with ecological agriculture designed for meeting the food needs of the people and providing for their health. That is the other road that we must walk, and many of us are walking. It simultaneously solves three problems. The first problem, of course, is the problem of hunger, which is a problem of health. The second is the problem of toxic contamination. These days, out of the Punjab, where I mentioned the whole rise of terrorism, the heavy use of pesticides has led to so much cancer that now there's a train called the cancer train that leaves Punjab. Half the people on that train are cancer victims. And they're going to a hospital that is public hospital and gives treatment for free. Because if you can't get free treatment, you can't afford cancer treatment. The very famous case of Novartis, which tried to sue India because our movement had managed to put a clause into our patent law that only genuine inventions would get a patent. But Novartis wanted an old drug to be patented. The Indian equivalent is sold for 10,000 rupees for a month of treatment. The Novartis version would have cost 145,000 rupees for a month of treatment. And when the debate was going on, Novartis said, we'll still make our money because for us, India is not a billion people. India is 150 million people who can afford to pay high prices. And that's how basically they see this. Now, of course, Mr. Bush, interestingly, has the same view, that India is not a billion people, 60% of whom grow food, all of them need food. He said, the reason the prices are rising is because these Indians are getting rich and eating too much. He literally said it. The point is, there's a limit to how much you can eat. It's the poor who weren't eating enough and could have eaten more, but they're eating less. Their per capita consumption has dropped from 177 to 150 kilograms per capita per day, eating less. And even while India's economy shoots up to 9% and 10%, India has emerged as the epicenter of malnutrition. The malnutrition of the poor, we have more hungry children in India today than Africa. There are more women denied food today in India than Africa. Even though Africa is the face of hunger, but the reality is an economy which dispossesses people of their land, their livelihoods, obviously creates hunger. Even the rich actually are not doing so well because the substitution is for our good food, and I must say Indian food is rather good. You know, we have a balanced diet, we eat about 30 things every meal, lots of herbs, lots of masalas, all our micronutrients taken care of. Even when you're vegetarian, you get your protein through your dals. All that's getting knocked out as a Kellogg's Corn Flakes advertises, you don't have to eat chapati anymore. Chips, Frito-Lay Pepsi chips are the staple of the young children. Diabetes has shot up from 7% to 14% in the last decade among little children in the schools of the cities. So the rich are getting malnutrition, the poor are getting malnutrition. As a result of which, what you have probably in the world today is the single biggest crisis that's affecting health of people, the environment, the climate, and livelihoods of the poor, all three. One can solve all three problems, the poverty problem, the hunger problem, the environmental problem, at one stroke. The first step is to not allow corporate control over our agriculture. Now, the World Bank will go to the FAO meeting, to the United Nations meeting, and will argue, and is already saying, that we will give more grants to spread more chemicals and seeds to the third world. Bill Gates is already waiting for an alliance for the Green Revolution for Africa. All of this is for the chemical industry, which is the pharmaceutical industry, which is the biotechnology industry, to get a deeper control. But wherever they have got control, farmers have been pushed to suicide, into debt, people have gone hungry. So if we allow their message to spread, we're going to have more hunger in the world. And the only counter is to work from the base on other models. Now, I have a lot of hope in this because we do it ourselves. And I can tell you, $1 of solidarity support is probably equal to $100,000 of the corrupt money of World Bank helping a Monsanto and a Cargill get a market. We don't have to be equal to them in money because we can beat them out through our solidarity. Now, in terms of what are the steps for solidarity, let me run through this quickly. The first is, as we talked yesterday, we have to reclaim our seeds as a commons. If we don't have the seeds, we cannot grow the food. If we do not have the seeds of nutritious crops, we will be condemned to a diet of genetically engineered corn and genetically engineered soya, and we will not be able to find an alternative. Already, Monsanto is telling the Europeans, get rid of your ban, because we have to solve the problem of hunger. For this, my dream is, and I hope we can do this together, that every woman in the South and every family in the North have a tiny garden, a herbal garden, a kitchen garden, where we grow the vital nutrients that we need and simultaneously grow the crops that create alternatives to the pharmaceuticals, where it's doable. And it's totally doable because Ayurveda treats without chemicals, and it is possible to grow the 15, 20 herbs in a backyard and solve both the pharmaceutical dependency and the food dependency. The second is we have to get rid of toxics in agriculture, which means ecological farming and organic farming. The third, if we have to get out of this food slavery, which means hunger, we have to become more local in the way we deal with our food. And that means creating solidarity economies. It's not difficult. Everyone needs to eat. That's the wonderful thing about food. Everyone has to eat. And either you eat badly and live in a food hell, or you eat well and live in a food heaven. But the food heaven will not be given to us by Cargill and Monsanto. It will not be given to us by World Bank, IMF, and WTO. The heaven of food will be co-created by us working with nature and local communities. Every eater connected to farmers, every farmer connected in their neighborhood to direct marketing. It needs effort, but nothing good takes place without effort. Effort is our strength, solidarity is our strength, and I do believe we can counter this last struggle of death-creating greed with a life-generating freedom that we all can exercise. Thank you.